Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Hey, hey. It's time for more Leaving Hillsong. Speaking of Leaving Hillsong, Brian Houston resigned from 15 out of 16 boards this week. So for all intents and purposes, he might be the one leaving next. In this episode, we're going to start looking at trauma and the trauma produced by places like Hillsong and churches like it. I'm beyond honoured to bring you a conversation I had a couple of months ago with Sean Namorin. He spent some formative years in a place he calls the Institution. He went on to work for the UNHCR for over a decade on the front line with people in refugee communities. He's also got a master's in social work with a specialty in trauma. And he's got a lot to share with us about what he's seen and what he's lived through and his perspectives. I'm privileged to call him a friend, and yet you'll hear my nerves. Sean's a very humble man, and I know it's taken him a while to get to the place now where he wants to talk about all of these things. So I asked him the standard question, how did you end up in a church like that?
I guess I should probably start with my parents. And, you know, they're from the island of Mauritius, which is off the east coast of the African continent and not far from Madagascar. And my parents identify as Creole, which is it broadly depicts an ethnic group with French cultural ties, yes, and predominantly Roman Catholic. My parents migrated to Australia in the 1970s, and I was born in the early 80s. And I guess you could call my parents, as Franz Fanon might describe, as the upwardly mobile and aspirational, perhaps like many migrants. And yet, you know, I've also got to say that what is true and a common experience amongst the migrant class might be something that I experienced growing up as a child. Confusion around a sense of place and around identity and a feeling of commonality, being one of the few brown kids growing up in the place that I did. And I guess you could say that this manifested itself in self-esteem issues. And it was probably only a lot later that I came to realize just how much. And, you know, I guess I was quite a talented kid growing up and reasonably intelligent, good at sports and music. And yet, it never really seemed to matter, or perhaps it was because of those identity issues and matters of self-perception, which influences, you know, that influenced at the time that success or that talent, you know, to prove something to myself. And, you know, Gabor Mate talks about that a bit, and, you know, how in his own life that hyper success and perhaps something, you know, a form of addiction, the need for affirmation, you know, maybe self-affirmation, yet the underlying need was to heal a much deeper trauma. You know, I spent time in a, you know, a very large and...
You grew up in a suburban area connected to a major city, and it was, mm-hmm. what would you say, pretty much a common Australian upbringing?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the aspirational class, you could say. I don't think that was the thing that really drew me. And because I grew up going to church. I'm just going to call it the institution, to be honest. I don't even think that it's really a church. I was raised Catholic. It's you know, deeply important within the Creole community in Mauritius. And obviously this was something that was, you know, transplanted here. I guess I never felt much life in that faith. However, you know, to me, in the ritual of the Catholic Church, and I never really felt a really deep connection to the divine. And maybe that's something that I was always looking for. I was always looking for the metaphysical. And, you know, also, I was also looking for a deep sense of meaning and a deep sense of community. But I could never really find that within the Catholic Church in the time. But, you know, one thing I have to say, that what interested me in the Catholic Church was probably more so the sense of mission and, you know, a social justice focus. You know, I went to a Catholic high school, and I was deeply impacted by some of the brothers who were, you know, my teachers there. And there was one in particular, you know, I can mention his name, you know, Brother Malachi, and he was my English teacher. And in another life, you know, he'd been a principal in a school in Soweto during apartheid. And, you know, he had taught all over the world as a vocation. You know, one of the things that I recall from those times was, you know, spending hours talking to him, you know, sometimes in the playground or after class, you know, and we'd discuss anything from Gregorian chant to social justice issues and the anti-racism movement. And, you know, I recall amongst those brothers, you know, a deep intellect, but also a deep faith and a deep mission in terms of their sense of purpose and around providing education for young people. Also, I've got to say that, you know, other Catholic figures, you know, such as, you know, people like Oscar Romero, Father Damien of Molokai, and probably much later, Ignacio Martin Barro, the Jesuit priest and psychologist who was murdered by right-wing paramilitaries in El Salvador, you know, they had a deep impact on my life and also on the way that I view the world. And, you know, Barrow, he had a huge impact on my later career as a torture and trauma therapist, particularly around his work looking at the impact of systemic state-sponsored terrorism on individuals and communities. So I guess you could say I was a bit of an odd kid. I used to think a lot. What I lacked was a sense of belonging.
You were attending Mass weekly with your family?
Yeah, probably would have been at least once a month, if not, you know, if not weekly. Sometimes, you know, we tend to go more often. Yeah, but in school, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I went through all the sacraments and, you know, confirmation and all that jazz. Yeah, as I went on, I think there was a greater thirst for a sense of belonging. I remember when I was in high school, and you know, it's interesting because I was reading this wonderful book recently by the linguist Daniel Everett, and he was formerly a missionary and a linguist researching the Pinaha people in the Brazilian Amazon. And, you know, and they are one of the few true hunter-gatherer tribes in existence today. And, you know, he spent 30 years amongst this wonderful community. And, you know, his book not only documents the intricacies of Pinaha life, but it similarly documents his moving away from the church through his association with them. And interestingly, and also since the colonization of that country, they are one of the only indigenous groups which has never had a convert to Christianity. But I digress a little bit. You know, his book also documents the beautiful way in which the community structures their life. And given that they are traditional hunter-gatherers, you know, we can extrapolate data pertaining to how, you know, how our own ancestors lived and perhaps how we've evolved as humans to feel and structure our human interactions. I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, he describes a scenario where the young people in that tribe don't have the same sense of angst which is synonymous with our own. You know, there are no existential questions, you know, we often find debilitating. And, you know, these are the things that I'd think about often, you know, what is our meaning and what is purpose? And the thing that I'd been connected to culturally and also within the country that I was living in, a lot of these questions weren't asked, you know. However, juxtaposed against a community like the Pinaha, they have their law, you know, they have their rites of passage, and they had that intimate connection to a community. And you know, I never felt that growing up, you know, a deep sense of purpose, and there was a thirst for meaning. And of course, as I mentioned before, this was coupled with my own feeling of low self-esteem. And so it was around that time that, you know, one of my friends invited me to a youth group that he was involved with, and it was a Christian one. And you know, yet we had connected as friends through music. You know, we often used to play bass together. So I trusted him, and actually we're still close friends today. You know, when there were some bad experiences, I guess it becomes a tendency to only focus on that bad. But later, you know, I admit, you know, it wasn't all that bad. And this first time, it was one of the first times I generally felt connected to something. And, you know, I recall going to this meeting, and there probably would have been maybe, you know, 20 young people. It was in many ways, it was quite a beautiful experience. And I experienced this a lot later, you know, when I was working in the UN, living in a context where you feel that you rely on your neighbor or your colleague for your survival, right? Emotional survival in context of, you know, insecurity. But that feeling, that connected feeling is something that is so inherently human, right? And I think that a lot of people are looking for that. You know, they're looking for that sense of tribe. They're looking for that sense of purpose, but not just as an individual, but also a sense of purpose with others. And it was probably around the same time that I was really seeking for this. And
why would a young man who's achieving so much and playing sports and doing all the things and ticking all the boxes that people think leads to self-esteem, why do you think you suffered from that low self-esteem? Is that to do with not having the connectedness that others had?
I think there's definitely a part of that, or the perception, because maybe the others also didn't feel the same, right? Mm. But, you know, I was talking a little bit about, you know, about Gabor Mate, right, and about the idea of that hyper success being a form of addiction. And his circumstance was that he was a Holocaust survivor. The thing that motivated his success was a deeper trauma. And it was the thirst for that sense of affirmation. It was a thirst for the sense of that you are doing well, right? That sense that self-affirmation, but also external affirmation. And, you know, he persists that in terms of, you know, his own experience, but that of many others. People who are hyper successful is because they need to be hyper successful. They need to feel that they're doing well. Otherwise, there is a deep hole in their existence. And I think that for me, in terms of things that I was doing well, it wasn't fulfilling at all. But the thing that I was lacking was that sense of community, because I feel that healing comes within. It comes through attachment. It comes through others. It comes through a feeling of safety. Yes. It comes through a feeling of connected. It comes through acceptance. That's what I was looking for. And I'll tell you about the time that, you know, that I felt this probably for the first time. And it was in this circumstance whereby I was with a group of 20 people, and, you know, there was this, you know, this pastor or whatever, and he gave the message. And, you know, afterwards, you know, he asked, you know, if anyone had a feeling, a calling towards God, please put up their hand. And you know, I was 16 at the time, and I looked at him and I put up my hand and I said, I had that feeling. You know, maybe it wasn't God. You know, maybe it was a sense of connectedness. Maybe it was a sense of acceptance, that feeling that who you are didn't matter. You know, that there was someone who loved you, and it was a community with whom you could find belonging. But isn't that the divine, right? Isn't that God? At least my perception, yes, of God, that is it. You know, I believe a lot in Jungian psychology, and particularly around ideas around the collective unconscious and about the way that humans narrativize their lives and the way that they structure their ideas, you know, in archetypes and things like that. And that is why I generally believe in the truth of that. And I believe that there is, you know, that connectedness to the divine in that experience, that was truth, in the same way that I've seen similar all across the world that I've lived in Muslim countries, in Buddhist countries, you know, in communist countries, where we're feeling people feel connected to something else. And I feel there is truth in that.
It's a wonderful explanation. It's beautiful.
And you know, also another thing that is so powerful, particularly around some things in Christian action, in evangelical movements, and maybe it's unconscious or maybe it isn't, but afterwards, you know, when I said what is commonly known as the sinner's prayer, you know, you had 20 young people reach over and laid hand on me as, you know, as you pray. And it was like a communal group hug, you know.
Wow.
And you know what?
Wow.
There was a feeling of wholeness that came over me. And yeah, it was healing. Yeah. I understand that. I support, you know, the deconstructionist movement, and I support ideas around trying to basically process a lot of these things that I'm describing. But for me, it felt real. And it was real, right? And it's easy to sort of to deconstruct everything to the nth degree and to say, oh, yeah, someone was primed and yeah, absolutely, that might have been the case, right? But for me, this was real and it felt real. And, you know, I think that what's interesting, and perhaps in this current COVID situation, you know, the healing power of touch. And, you know, across many cultures, people heal through touch. And it's poignant that hands and touch are an integral part in, you know, of healing in Christianity as it is in others. Yeah, and it's the same concept in other cultures where, you know, that healing through touch, it isn't attributed to God at all. You know, I remember feeling like that feeling at the time, you know, you felt like a little bit like an emotional leper, right? And even though, you know, you have a very close family and you have close friends and you're doing really well, but that feeling of being connected to something, the feeling of being whole, it was absent. And maybe it's because in so many ways our, you know, our societies have made social capital redundant. We no longer really rely on our neighbors for our collective survival in the same way that we might have in the past. So people are screaming out for this stuff. And maybe that's the same reason as to why many people feel attracted to some of these movements around the world and in industrialized countries. Sometimes a little bit later, you can see some of the rationale behind or see some of the motivations from others. So that whilst, you know, your experience was true and, you know, what I described before was something really poignant for me, right? And, you know, even describing it just now, you know, I got a little bit emotional, right? And because it did have an impact and I did realize the reason, right? To put it into perspective, so when I came back many years later, you know, I worked overseas and I was overseas for a decade or so. And so I work with the United Nations. After I came back, I ended up going, and it had been many years since I'd really been actively involved in the church, but I just wanted to go back. And maybe it was a desire for, you know, to feel connected to the place that I was living in or just, I don't know, many reasons maybe. But I went back to the same place that I experienced that conversion story and the same pastor, and he didn't know me from a bar of soap. And you know, we talked about this and he didn't recall it at all, right? And I guess that is so poignant in some of the, you know, it's such a poignant example and feeling that, you know, there was this focus on influence, there was this focus on souls. It almost felt like the economy of people, like the economy of souls, in that there wasn't a reverence of the individual who was engaged in that. That was just, it just felt like that person was like a scalp. That was one number. And it was after that that I just decided that I was never going to go again. And it was after, yeah.
And how old are you at this point?
I mean, this would have been about 5 years ago. So there was many, many years after this experience. I can forgive the person for not remembering, right? But I suppose it sort of puts it into perspective when something so intimate for you obviously meant nothing to the other individual, or it just was just one part of many involved in, right?
It does sound quite impersonal, because you would have thought that that would have stuck with them. It's not like you were part of the millions that came later.
Maybe that's what the focus is. Like, the focus in a lot of evangelical movements isn't around the building up of individuals, right? Or, you know, maybe they might perceive that is the focus, but it's about, you know, the focus is more on the external and growth and things like that. So it does have, at least in my perspective, something of an internalized capitalistic sort of narrative and idea. Yeah, and I feel like I didn't want to be a part of, you know, and I mean, these were ideas I was developing, you know, back in my teens and early 20s as well. But I didn't feel that I wanted to be a part of that economy, you know, the economy of souls, as what I described earlier. The reverence of people's stories, the reverence of,
yes,
you know, in many ways in these mega institutions, it feels so impersonal. There isn't a reverence of individuals' particular stories, right? And maybe that's one of the reasons people just feel like a number.
That's the direct opposite of how it starts. It's so personal, and it's so humble, yes, and intimate, and so interesting how growth leads to that, just eliminating, yes, all of that. What happened after that?
Yeah, so after that, started then going to, you know, a place that was closer to my home. And previously I described that, you know, I ended up going to, you know, a relatively large institution that was just down the road. Of course, it was a lot smaller than what it is now, but suffice to say that this place has a global reach. What was interesting is that I ended up going with a group of friends from school and all quite closely knit. But what was interesting was that the experience of many of the other people in the group, you know, whilst of course, you know, it wasn't identical to my own, but, you know, in reflecting back, there are a lot of attachment issues amongst, you know, some of the others, you know, with broken families and issues around mental health. And I think that's something that is quite poignant to reflect on, in that there are certain people that feel maybe more of a pull towards institutions that whereby they feel a sense of connectedness, they feel a sense of belonging, they feel a sense of safety, maybe that they didn't or hadn't otherwise received elsewhere.
I'm just, while we're thinking here, I wonder if that's got something to do with these institutions' large success in Australia specifically, because there are so many disenfranchised people from all over, yes, the world, yes, missing their villages, missing their entire culture, yes, and not necessarily recognising it.
Yes.
I just wonder if that's why they were so successful at that time.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
During migration in the 80s and 90s, where population of coal communities in these institutions, but I'm wondering if that had any influence. Hey, anyway.
You know, I think it's also important to say, and you know, it's, you know, it would be disingenuous to say that all the experience was bad. You know, I spent my formative years staying in this place. And, you know, I went through a long time where the only thing that I could focus on was the bad stuff, right? And yeah. It really did consume my mind for many years, particularly after I left, even if my life, you know, might have been relatively successful at that time. These were things that they used to pry on my mind and to try to unpack these things. And this was at a time that, you know, there wasn't deconstruction podcasts or anything like that. It was just basically me sitting down and trying to understand what the hell I'd experienced, right? It was hard to focus on the good things.
Right.
And, you know, I'm a big proponent of narrative therapy. And the basic idea behind this concept is that, you know, a survivor self-identifies or overemphasizes a problem-saturated narrative, right? So this could be many things. It could be abuse. It could be religious trauma. It could be rape. It could be many things, right? And then someone self-identifies with that trauma. So they think that, you know, I deserve that, or I am the trauma. So it becomes all encompassing of their life. But the thing is, healing comes through a reflection on the other stories. So enriching one's perspective on the diversity of the stories, you know, their skills, experiences that might be outside of that dominant narrative. So maybe my own healing was similarly applicable through that same idea that, you know, initially I felt, you know, a great sense of purpose and a feeling to community. And it was good, you know. And I guess one of the great things as well, that there were a few existential questions at that time. You know, I was born again, and, you know, there was that feeling that, you know, I was going to heaven. And whilst it could be described by some as, you know, drinking Kool-Aid, I admit that that experience was liberating. You know, and for many years, going through that process of reevaluating my life and my purpose and my goals and values, you know, sometimes I have to say that I missed it. You know, there were some genuine people, yeah.
Probably 90% of the people you will find in those buildings are genuine people trying hard to do good things, and that's why they're there. And the Kool-Aid stuff doesn't come till much later.
Yes.
By no means downplay the magnificence of what takes place.
I think that's also a message for other people, right? In that, to do an audit and to reflect on not just the traumatic experiences, and I know it's really hard to do so, but to have a reflection on the diversity of experiences at that time. You know, it's hard to generalize a place as large as the one that we're talking about, in the same way that it's hard to generalize an institution like the Catholic Church, as we described previously, right? Because whilst, of course, there are those many circumstances of abuse, but there's also the things that I focus on as well, like things around, you know, social justice and those figures that I find, that I found deeply inspiring. I can't comment on as to whether it is a conscious thing. One thing that I know, particularly in terms of human relationships, when, say, for example, someone who has attachment issues, who might have attachment issues with primary caregiver, right, in that we replicate the relationships that we have a lot later they were basically fermented in 0 to 5. So when there isn't that sense of safety around that particular period, that sometimes we can replicate a similar relationship with an intimate partner in the same way that we had when we're young. So we didn't necessarily go out to purposely seek someone who might be similar abusive as to what our a parent was, right?
I see.
But that's just what happens. In the same way that the individual that we end up with, right, is also attracted to someone with similar characteristics. People, you know, who have attachment issues might find themselves in similar relationships unconsciously in institutions like the church.
After that first night, what happened after that?
After that first night, you know, I decided to go to a place that was closer to my house. And, you know, I ended up going with this group of friends with whom I had at school. And from there, I became deeply involved in the youth ministry. And I spent a number of years in the youth ministry at the time. And this was in the late 90s. And then afterwards, I became a leader in the youth ministry, and then I was a Bible study group, and I would have been a leader in the youth ministry for another 5 years.
Well, okay.
And then abruptly I just left, and then I never went to the place again.
So you were talking a little bit before about all the things you'd seen having an effect on you.
Yeah, I think it probably was something of a cumulative thing. So, you know, whilst a lot of the things that I experienced previously, you know, had a deep and positive impact, I think it was a cumulative experience of sort of moving away from the institution until one day I suddenly just didn't want to go anymore. And previously I was talking about attachment and I was using sort of that as a framework for understanding maybe one of the reasons as to why people go to large institutions like this. And I think that within some of those relationships, they used to control. And at least in terms of some of the things that I was observing in this institution was around having quite a need for control. As to whether it was always conscious or something purposeful, I don't want to hypothesize. I guess I have my own ideas. I think sometimes it was generally well-meaning, right? But also it was also quite damaging as well. And then maybe one of the examples that I can give was around a concept of reporting, right? You know, I mentioned that I was one of the leaders in the youth ministry, and there was a time whereby, because I was a psychology student at the time, and I mean, I was hardly qualified or anything like that, they asked if I could oversee the well-being arm of the high school youth ministry at the time. And, you know, I knew that it had been a practice of people reporting on the young people that are in their care, but I didn't quite see it at more of a systemic level. And it was one time that I agreed and I started doing this, and you know, that they handed me a spreadsheet of names, effectively, of, it was something along the lines of a sin sheet that people wanted me to oversee or support. And
wow,
you know,
okay.
there was you know, Johnny or Timmy or whatever, and there was sort of something that they were struggling with. So, you know, Timmy might, you know, and it was all written down, has homosexual thoughts or tendencies. Janie is masturbating or whatever, right?
Oh, God, where was this kept?
Yeah, see, and that was the thing that I had such a huge issue, right? So I received this and I looked at them and then I asked, have their parents consented to having any documentation on their kids? And basically, I was quite disgusted in receiving this. And I told them, I said, I don't want to see anything like this again. And I think it's probably illegal in terms of what you're doing, right? And the thing was that I found so difficult, particularly around exchanges like this, which happened quite, you know, it's more of like, who are you to question us? Like, in the hierarchy of the institution, you do not have the authority to be able to say to us that what we're doing is wrong. In circumstances whereby they're pulled up on issues pertaining to ethics, pertaining to just dodgy behavior or things like this. And you know what? They might not have even really been privy to it, right? But it's, for me, it was blindingly obvious that you don't write reports on young people. Yeah, it was in a database. The head of the youth ministry, I don't know where else. But I received this and I said, I don't want to see it again. I think that it's probably borderlining on, you know, on criminality, but it's definitely not something that I think that we should be doing. It wasn't received in the way that, okay, well, you know, okay, this person might know a little bit more and thank you for that input. We're not going to do this anymore. It was sort of like it was received with anger in that, like, who are you to tell us that what we're doing is something that's unethical, something that we shouldn't be doing, right? And this happened quite often during my time because I wasn't someone who was, you know, I was always quite forthright in terms of my opinions, in terms of things, and it probably didn't really, you know, influence my relationships with others quite positively and maybe for the better. But yeah, so there was this issue around control. There was this issue around, you know, the need to know everything about people's lives, the young people, and I found that of great concern.
There's no part of you that thinks that there was some altruistic or positive motivation in keeping those records. Those weren't prayer sheets. They were control sheets, is that?
I think that maybe there might have been some well-intentioned focus, particularly in terms of the framework in which they were looking at the world in terms of sinning and blah, blah. But they couldn't see that something like that, particularly getting in the hands of others or just in terms of ethical record keeping or anything like that, it was something that you just don't do. So on one hand, there might have been some altruistic motivation for such, but no, I mean, it was dodgy as, and you don't do those things.
What kind of an impact do you think those kinds of records have on people when they're considering leaving?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, this was many years ago. And the thing was, is that after that I made a fuss, it was known that I did, right? And they supposedly stopped this practice. But you know what? I don't know. I really can't say as to whether, because I think that there probably was something along, you know, that there was an attitude that was probably ingrained within the institutions and the machinations of said institution that probably needed to know information in order for them to make decisions based on such or whatnot, yeah.
Well, this is what the Bible College students have reported this year, is that they're asked all kinds of questions on admission.
Sure.
About their recent sexual history specifically, and then are allocated or not allocated positions because of that. So sure. It's definitely an ongoing practice.
I mean, I'm not really privy to that circumstance, but this is something that happened 20 years ago. So, I mean, hey, if there hasn't been an evolution of that, well, you know, it might mean that this is something that, in fact, they very much intended to do.
No wonder so many people don't speak or don't want to tell their story, or as so many journalists have found, cancel.
Yeah.
Because they know there's sin sheets sitting somewhere, you know, like in a Scientology office somewhere.
One of the main reasons as to why I'm talking to you today is because, you know, many years ago when I was struggling with some of these issues, when you came out, you were the first person or one of the first people who publicly talked about some of these things, you know, was trying to come up with a why, asking those questions. The thing is, if a place like this was like a local church in, you know, in the corner of a small town that had no aspirations in being anything more than what it was, 50 people serving those individuals, okay, all right, whatever. But even that, it's these things there wouldn't have been good, right? But the fact is that the aspirations of institutions like this, not just this, but other large, multi, mega, whatever you want to call mega churches or mega institutions around the world, they aspire to be bigger. They aspire to be more influential. They aspire to have that global influence. And with that comes responsibility, and with that comes accountability. So when you have a public profile like that, you need to accept that there's going to be scrutiny in terms of things like that, because it's not just the lives of a few, it's the lives of thousands sometimes. So, and I was so inspired when, you know, when there was no one else who was coming out, but you came out. And then I reached out to you, and I found that quite cathartic in some of the discussions that we're having around that time after I'd left the institution and after I was working in the United Nations overseas. I mean, we used to have conversations when I was in Bangladesh or when I was in, some war in Mali or wherever, and so that I was experiencing those things there. But the things that I had experienced previously, I was just trying to make sense of it. You know, that's one of the reasons as to why I'm talking to you today is I respect what you did then, and it was not easy to stick your neck out like that, and I think that it was deeply inspirational, you know, and very brave to be able to ask those questions. And because, you know, it's a powerful institution, right? And well, we need to ask questions in terms of how are people being treated, you know, are there things that are unethical, and what are some of the ways in which these things can be improved? Yeah.
And so my thing has always been just about documenting the information, just to put out an alternative point of view. And that's what I'm so excited about all of these interviews, is getting all those different perspectives out there. One of the things that's always stuck out for me talking with you is that level of accountability that you've reported in your roles is so necessary. Yeah. You can't just, you know, get government grants and not say where they're going or what you're using them for.
And also in terms of our personal conduct and the way that we associate with those that we work with. And you know what? Like I've lived a very flawed life. I've been made accountable to the mistakes that I've made, and rightfully so. And dare I say, I believe that in the future I will also be made to be accountable for the mistakes I made, particularly vis-a-vis others, right? I hope that I don't make mistakes, and sometimes it might be unintentional, but it's inevitable that I might hurt people in the future. I do hope that, you know, when someone might bring something up to me, that I will be able to properly reflect on the things that that person or whatever is being said, and then try to be reflective enough to be able to change that and to be honest in terms of myself, what were the motivations which led to this thing, and then make necessary changes. But unfortunately, I haven't always seen that to be one of the circumstances within this institution, particularly in times where I brought things up, where, you know, I'd either observed or had experienced some hurtful behavior or whatnot, and it wasn't always received in that way. Either the blame was placed on myself, or it was just completely ignored, right? Because it was something that was quite difficult, you know, to receive, I suppose. And I think a lot of that comes within that paradigm of, you know, of the leader and the follower, right? So in a hierarchical institution like this, so you have these charismatic figures, and then the charismatic figures need a flock of people to follow them. And that was always something that made me quite uncomfortable, right? When I started going into this, because I had no choice in terms of who was the person that I had to then think that this was the leader that I had to follow. It was a decision that was made outside of my consciousness, I suppose.
Well, it's not a democracy there, is it, at all? You don't get to choose the king. Not.
And in a way, I've sort of developed an element of compassion, I could say, for people in contexts like this, particularly in those leadership positions, because you know what? Like, I described a scenario whereby people were coming to me in terms of the wrong that I've done and then having to try to do better. It must be exhausting to feel or believe that you need to be infallible or you need to be perfect. It must be absolutely exhausting to go through life like that. You know, you need to feel that you are that leader. You need to be, you know, you need to take on that persona that, you know, otherwise is self-attributed or has been attributed by some other, because, you know, a lot of those people, they're not perfect people. And more often than not, sometimes they're pretty horrible people. But to go through life where you're constantly curating a persona where you can never show fallibility, where you can never show weakness externally, it must be extremely exhausting. And in many ways, I feel very sorry for them.
You know, imagine having to be bouncy all the time, yes, all weekend. You'd never be able to go down the shop and have an off day. You know, who is a product of the machine? Mm. You know, I look at someone like Carl Lentz, who was 21 when he first got really stuck into it.
Yes.
I mean, it's an adult, but it's a very young age to be put under, you know, and it suits that age, but it's still quite a young age to become, as you say, so attached.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember Carl from those years ago, you know. But I suppose one of the things that always fascinated me was, you know, the notion of how do you become a pastor? How do you become a leader in those contexts? And at least from my perception, the only prerequisite was a close relationship with the leadership. And, you know, it's something that the Chinese like to call guangxi, you know, which is relationships.
Thank you, Sean. And I hope everybody really enjoyed that. It took me quite a few listens to absorb everything, all the really rich layers behind this. And in a lot of ways, that was just the warm-up. That was just to get to know Sean a little bit, because next week's going to be incredibly powerful and next week's going to be next level. So look after yourselves. Oh, and please keep up the likes, follows, subscribes, comments, all of those things. And drop a Patreon if you can. $3 a month will go a really long way if you choose the Loose Change Larry category. And we'll talk then.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.